$16.99. Oh, great. David Padanky. Come up here, David.
Huh?
Come up here, David.
Here.
To testify.
Oh.
What did you just think I said, David?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. We're on House Bill 2353.
We'll do it again.
Thank you.
Open the public hearing for the second time, officially, the 16th day of June 1999, on House Bill 2353. The only person who signed up to testify for this bill and might be noted against it is David Padanky, ACLU of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that we have that here for the...
And now you've been joined by the good senator from Pendleton, Senator...
I think I'm here to make sure you're having
Nelson.
A little balance from the right.
He's a dude, remember that? Opposed to a wrangler. You know the difference between a dude and a wrangler?
I don't,
Mr. Chair. I wasn't talking to you. Do you know the difference between a dude and a wrangler?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
Do you want to know the difference?
I would love to.
He's a dude, which means he's a phony cowboy. A wrangler is one who really goes out there and gets physical with the animals and with Mother Nature. I'm not making it up. Is that right, Senator Nelson?
That's a good definition. Right?
And you are a dude, not
I admit
wrangler.
That. I admit that. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
How does a wrangler get physical with the animals?
Well, I'm not. You know, they do things with animals. They throw ropes on them, and they wrestle them, and they jump on them.
Random.
And they brand them, and they run after them, and they get dust in their eyes, their face, their lungs. They get on horses, and they
swear a lot.
They swear, and they say body stays in, and they wear thick leather and stuff like that. David, how still... Oh.
Busted again.
I've already opened this.
I'm glad you did. Thank you.
So, David, you're under oath. Tell me what went on
No, Mr. Chair, I am not under oath. I understand we are having a public hearing on House Bill 2353, which is the ballot title for the proposed referrals of the Measure 40 measures, the Measure 40 rewrites. And I am testifying in opposition to this bill, mostly because we do not believe it's necessary, and also to urge the committee to hang on to this, at least until after the committee has completed its work on HRs 87 through 94, since it is our hope that the substance of some of those measures may change between now and then. And at a minimum, these ballot titles should be modified to reflect whatever changes the Senate makes. However, it's important for you to know that the legislature is not required to draft ballot titles for referrals. There is a procedure under statute that would provide that the Attorney General would draft ballot titles for any legislative referrals if the legislature does not do so. The good thing about this bill is that it does at least permit Supreme Court review of the ballot titles. And there had been a provision in the original bill that would have precluded Supreme Court review of the ballot titles, which we strongly objected to and which we believe would have resulted in a veto by the governor. So that's the extent of my testimony, Mr. Chair. We believe the bill is unnecessary, but if you're going to draft the ballot titles, then at least take a close look at this after you complete your work on HRs 87 through 94.
And my intent is to bring this bill back with the HRs as we go into work session on those. So as we make changes, they would be reflected in what we're doing here. Also, for those who are proponents of the bill, I wanted to do the public testimony so I could go into work session, but I will invite proponents and the Attorney General's office to discuss the bill when it comes before us in work session, so they won't be precluded. And Thursday, HJR. I believe we have Mr. Kadeke scheduled on the HJR.
Okay.
Invitation. By invitation. So you'll be the only witness. She is our last witness on the HJR, and I wanted to complete the public testimony this week. So I hope you have that on your calendar.
I sure do.
Tomorrow's calendar may be adjusted slightly depending upon the budget negotiations, because Senator Brown and I will be involved in those. But we'll leave it at 1 o'clock. But we'll know tonight about 9 o'clock if the budget negotiations during that time. And then I'll talk to Senator Courtney, and we'll arrange a time where at least Senator Brown actually gets a part of the team.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That then concludes the public hearing on 2353. Mr. Taylor, what would be another one to go to right now? That
Sure, you're looking for people to testify or looking for bills where there's no one signed up?
Looking for bills that people want to testify on that we can do the public hearings on as a smaller group. All right, we will open as a subcommittee to take public hearing on public testimony on HB 3304. And I would invite Paul Romaine and Ingrid Swenson. And since, Paul, you're the proponent, we'll let you go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. There is another proponent of the bill, Representative Judy Werbelow, who was expecting to get a phone call to come down and testify.
We will call her right now.
At the same time, but I would be happy to go ahead and give our position on this.
Please go ahead.
The Beer and Wine Distributors of Oregon support vehicle forfeiture as a way to combat the repeat drunk driver, the high-end drunk driver, and those people who are the true problems out in the road, the real killers. Basically, when somebody drinks and overdrinks and drives, they create a tremendous problem for the rest of us. Should I just continue?
Oh, please.
Okay. We are. I'm talking to my wife. Nobody pays attention. I just keep going.
We're listening, Paul. Peter always listens to Paul.
That's right. Are we getting Mary up here, or are we are singing?
It's a biblical thing.
Okay.
He's not to me.
Okay. Senator Nelson, beer and wine distributors are very much in favor of this bill. What you have with people who are repeat drunk drivers, especially within a short time frame, or people who are driving with a license that's been suspended from a drunk conviction, is a person who by their own behavior has admitted that they are a real problem to the rest of us out there. And something has to be done to shock them into submission to the reality that they have a problem. What we found was that vehicle forfeiture is one of those things that actually gets their attention and gets it greatly. And it gets the attention of the family. It is a hardship, but it's a better hardship than having that person go out and kill somebody. If you want to weigh the equities, I'd much prefer to be in a situation where I'm taking somebody's car and maybe preventing the loss of a life than waiting and giving them back their car and having them go out and kill. A number of years ago, then City Councilperson Earl Blumenauer, now Congressman Blumenauer, put in the bill in the city of Portland and called me, and I remember the conversation very vividly. He called me as a friend to give me a heads up because he thought he was going to have to run over me on this. He called to tell me that the city of Portland was going to put in a vehicle forfeiture provision. And I thought about it for a second, and I said, Earl, I'll come down and testify in favor of it. And we were the lead witnesses for Earl on his bill. It was almost a man-bites-dog story because industry traditionally doesn't get behind things that one would think would limit industry. But those of us in the beer and wine industry believe very strongly that we do have limits. And when people abuse the product, as they would with repeat drunk driving convictions or with driving while licenses suspended from a drunk conviction, we think you need to take action. So, again, we would highly support this bill And we know there are some problems with the existing draft. My suggestion to the House committee was to pass it over here in its current form so they could at least get it moving so we didn't run out of time, and that you would fix it. The fixes, I believe Judy, Representative Werblau will be bringing them, involve a time frame for multiple convictions. In other words, it's not two convictions within your lifetime, but two convictions within a three-year period of time. That's evidence of a serious problem. It is driving with a license that's been suspended. There has to be some trigger mechanisms at the first offense. In addition, I believe there may be some controversy over the procedural mechanism. We have no opinion on that. Whatever works is fine with us.
I think the financial institutions have a concern if in some way their security interests would be affected, or if they could be required to pay storage fees if they have to repossess it because of the seizure. Do you have any amendments that would take care of their concerns?
Mr. Chair, I do not. Those are very legitimate concerns, and I think they can be addressed. I believe the City of Portland has addressed them, and I would look for that to them for guidance. Again, my support is for the concept. I'll let those who are going to worry about their security interests worry about this particular language.
Senator Courtney.
I just need to know how this works. Is this to empower local governments to do it, or is it just a state law that mandates it out there so that a county sheriff or a city police officer or a state trooper simply, if this becomes law, can do it? And what I'm confused as to what, you keep bringing up the City of Portland and Blumenauer, but what about the City of Salem or the City of Woodburn or the County of Maryland? What about, I don't understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney.
Yes, a representative of Blumenauer.
Currently, jurisdictions have the authority, or they can pass their ordinances, as the City of Portland did. Some, Deschutes County, City of Portland, other places have ordinances. I will defer to the representative from Ashland to fill in the rest of these blanks that I, and before I dig the holes even deeper, let her kind of fill them in a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am the chief sponsor of this bill, and yes, Representative Courtney, in answer to your question, it has been felt by many jurisdictions that they can already do this under 475, and but there are other jurisdictions that weren't quite sure that they could, and just felt that they didn't want to move forward without some statewide law, and that's basically what we've done here. And in fact, is that this statute that we have proposed is modeled fairly closely to the Deschutes County one. We took the one that we had thought that, well, we knew that had been in place along this and had worked out some of the problems and had not had. So the problem, that's very interesting. Actually, this bill was first brought, I first brought this in 95, had it back in 97, have it back now. And as you will learn, there's all these different interest groups out there that have a concern here or a concern there. We've worked with them, and so we worked over a 4 or 5 month period in this session to try to meet all the needs. Well, that's impossible. I think probably Mr. Romaine has already testified he'd like it shrunk from 10 years to 3 years. I have no concern about that. We just used the 10 years because I think that one was the one in Deschutes County, and as I said, we were taking one that had been in existence for some time. The bankers will testify, although they didn't bring this up before, but now they have some concerns. Can they actually be notified within the 3 days that is here in the statute? And my response, they were concerned they couldn't. My response is, in my law practice, I pick up the phone all the time to find out what liens are on different properties, and this is a matter of public record, and I would assume that the agency, the public safety agency, could do that the same way if I do and find out what liens are fit and do the notification within 3 years. Multnomah County came with a whole different set of amendments, and that brings up the issue. When we were working, Lincoln County has this, Portland has it, Multnomah County's been working on it, Deschutes County, and they're all just a little different. And we were trying to fashion something here that would not do away with what they had. And we think we have done that. At one point, they wanted to have a grandfather clause in there, because that would very specifically say that all these people who have these programs are okay. It turned out, in talking to people in the House, that many did not want a grandfather clause because they thought that that could end up, you know, making a mishmash of programs that would depend where you are, what would happen to you, and that type of thing. But the way this is worded, even without the grandfather clause, the Schuster County and Lincoln County can keep operating, I think, as they have been, and so can Portland. Multnomah County is just doing a new one, and they think their new ideas are better than what's out there. I have real concern about adding a whole lot of amendments. You know, this process has been long and laborious, and you've had to bring a lot of people into it, and I think these individual concerns should not be to defeat it. As I said, I have no problem with changing 10 to 3. That's easily done. And we don't have to go back and revamp all of the language.
Senator Courtney.
Okay. You explained to me the cities and counties. If we pass this, in order to come under it, does the area you're driving in have to adopt some kind of program like this? For example, if you're driving to a county in Eastern Oregon, and you get stopped and you're in violation of one of the things here, but that county hasn't adopted anything like this, or you're in the city limits of La Grande, can the states, will this still apply?
This is a statewide law.
So this is going to be a statewide law?
Okay.
That's just making a whole lot more sense to me, because I knew a bunch of things are going on there.
Mm-hmm. And it's not mandatory, though. That needs to be it shall be declared a nuisance and subject to civil in rem forfeiture. So whoever picks you up, you know, whether it's the state police or a police person on the grand, this sets the framework. You do not. The vehicle becomes a nuisance, but it doesn't have to be forfeited. It's just subject to forfeiture. And one of the reasons we did that is there was a great concern in Eastern Oregon that area, maybe the family only has one car, that's their means of transportation, there are other people who could use it, that we felt the public safety people would know their area and be able to make this kind of determination. So we just said it's subject to forfeiture. We don't say you shall forfeit this.
Well, Judy, what happens to the financial institution that has the first lien on a car that's impounded and then forfeited? Do they have to pay the impounding fees?
And actually, everybody's having trouble with paying the impounding fees. The impounding fees will either fall on the public safety agency or the other people. We said that if you want to claim that car, that's in this agreement, that if you have, if you're a family member, it's impounded, and you're a family member that wants to claim the car, if you're a lien holder that wants to pay the car, you can get it out of impoundment as long as you pay the fees.
So the bank would have to pay.
That's right. And of course, they're not really excited about that either. But it was a balance act because many the state police testified they would have real difficulty, given their limited funds, to absorb this cost. And the state police testified they do not have their own impoundment lot, so they put them on private lots and they have to pay. So it was a balance act. Who pays to get this out?
If I can make a comment, it's interesting when we talk about who pays, and you're dealing here with a person who has exhibited repeat very hostile behavior to society. They've been convicted to trigger this under the new thing. Two convictions within 3 years, or driving when their license has been suspended from a drunk conviction. They are the ones that are causing the problems. They're the ones who are killing people, who are causing the accidents out there. in the legislature, you have a choice to make. You can keep going after the low-end drunk or person who consumes alcohol and do things, and I've run into dispute with some people in this body over lowering BAC and stuff like that, which creates a new class of criminals. Or you can go after the high-end person. This really does go after the repeat drunk driver, the one who's causing the problem. It works. The city of Portland loves what they have. It actually gets the person who's causing the problem off the road. They don't have a repeat offender problem with these people.
Judy, do you have an amendment?
No. As I said, Mr. Romaine came to us about an amendment from 10 years to 3 years, and I said I don't have any problem. I don't know if he went down and drafted. I did not. Some other people came to me with possible amendments, and I just felt like it was opening up the bill at this late time to an extent we didn't want to open it up, and so I did not move forward on those at all and told them that I was not willing to.
And have you seen the proposed amendments from the city of Portland?
Yes.
And your position on those?
My position is those, I just don't want to open up, it's very similar to this actually, but they have left the bankers out, they have, in fact, I have a copy, there were just some things that before those were entirely acceptable, we have to sit down and iron out. And you know, we spent 5 months talking to all these people, and I just felt they opened it up at this late date.
Where's the preemption clause in here?
I'm sorry, I'm under a call.
Oh.
I'll see you later.
Well, Ingrid can probably help you. She knows this bill very well. Ingrid, why don't you go ahead and testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the City, Ingrid Clinton, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are opposed to this bill. In its original form, it had some merit, which was basically to wait until a conviction and then move towards towards forfeiture if that was appropriate. In its current form, actually, not one conviction of DUII is required for forfeiture. You don't have to ever have been convicted. If you were diverted once in the past and then are simply arrested or cited, forfeiture occurs at that point. And that just doesn't make good sense to us. If we are truly after repeat offenders, they should at least be offenders, and it should be repeat offenders. It sounds to me like there's still a lot of discussion that needs to take place on this whole issue. I'm aware that communities have gone forward with forfeiture ordinances. There is a body whose function is to oversee and develop recommendations with respect to the forfeiture law, and that's the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. I do not know, frankly, whether this measure was considered in that body or not, but those are the folks who are the experts in this area. And I'm sure part of the concern is that you don't preempt communities from doing something they don't want to do, so that's why you wouldn't want to enact a state statute that didn't protect the local ordinances to the extent that they wanted to be tighter or something like that. But in my opinion, if the legislature were to go forward this session, it ought to be with respect to a criminal penalty, so that if somebody's convicted on a second or third or whatever DUII, you should be able to remove the instrumentality of that crime. And if that person is the sole owner of a vehicle and they're not, title hasn't been in the name of some other holder, well, that's an appropriate thing to do. There are lots of other questions that remain at this point with the bill. First of all, it says the vehicle shall be declared. It calls for an act, but it doesn't identify who is to declare it forfeited. Apparently, it's the police officer who is making the arrest, or is it not? Does the police officer decide to forfeit the moment of the citation, or does the police officer wait until he's conferred with other officials to talk about the value of this vehicle and all of these other factors before making that decision? Section 2 allows for forfeiture at the time of citation on the
DUII or driving while suspended offense. Section 3 says, well, you also have the power to impound the vehicle. So a choice can be made. And it's only if the decision is to impound only that these other holders have an opportunity to claim their interest. If indeed the vehicle is forfeited under Section 2, immediately upon citation, then it does not appear that any of these claimants have an opportunity to claim the vehicle, no matter how meritorious they're the basis of this claim. I talked to Sean McCray, who's an attorney who handles many of these forfeitures under drug laws and so forth in the Eugene area, and he indicated that there's a good deal of controversy under the existing forfeiture law with respect to the burden of proof. That has not been satisfactorily resolved at this point, and that's an issue upon which they're working in the whole chapter. In addition, the 21 days that is provided under the chapter for notice for filing of a claim has proven to be inadequate under the drug forfeiture law, or the general forfeiture law. Her concern is that we're building not only on those problems that are already in the law and have not been resolved, but creating entirely new ones with this measure. She pointed out to me a case of a client of hers who would have fallen under this provision. He was a University of Oregon student. He was driving in the state of Washington, was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol. He pled guilty, not knowing that he was eligible for diversion, but he pled guilty in Washington. His assumption was that he was prohibited from driving in Washington, but he did not understand that he was not free to drive in the state of Oregon. So sometime thereafter, he went to the Department of State Police to inquire about a matter related to his vehicle. They did a search and realized that he was indeed convicted of DUI and suspended from driving, and cited him for driving to the state police office. His vehicle would have been forfeitable under this provision, even though ultimately the DA dismissed the case and didn't charge him down there. That's irrelevant. The case can get dismissed, or you can be found not to be the driver. And still, this forfeiture provision has already taken place. It takes place the moment of the citation.
In the Chief County process, I haven't looked at it in the last couple of years, but my memory is it does require at least one conviction.
Mr. Chair, that would be different then, because here you could have been diverted rather than convicted. And people may well choose to be diverted even though they could successfully fight a conviction.
Question for you.
So can you ask the question? There's no preemption language in here.
Mr. Chair, I don't see any preemption language. Mr. Chair and Senator Kearney, I don't see any preemption language. However, if the state acts, if the state passes law that sort of occupies a field, then the court might construe that to be intended to be preemptive. So you'd have to exclude that intention, I would think.
Well, where did Paul get the idea that he had two convictions? Did you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, my understanding with Representative Webelow is she has agreed to the two convictions within a 3-year period of time, and I thought we were going to have amendments here for that. So I agree. You need the conviction of trigger mechanism. I believe two arrests or is not sufficient.
Did you include a diversion as being one of the two?
That's a policy decision for you to make. I would, frankly, because I think if you're diverted and then convicted again, you at least have the one conviction at that point. So, and if you're going to go with two or a diversion plus a conviction, and frankly, as far as the driving with a license that's been suspended for a drunk conviction, there may be mistakes made, and prosecutorial discretion may help in those situations. But generally speaking,
right.
You got a real serious problem person there.
Good question. We're not going to go into work session on this today.
I think Representative Webber will be coming back with some amendments for you. If you find it acceptable, probably.
All right, Lisa Nato.
Good Thank you, Senator. Could I bring, Chair, would it be possible to bring a couple of certified smart folks with me? Thank you.
That's a dangerous phrase.
I know that.
The Vice Chair.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lisa Nato. I'm Multnomah County Commissioner. And thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. With me, I have Dan Olden from our Sheriff's Office and Chris Carey from our District Attorney's Office, who've been working very hard on this issue over the last few months. We support the concept of a DUI forfeiture statute. In talking with Representative Werbelow, it does seem to be that a good idea to have some consistency statewide, and we support the concept because where treatment and sanctions do fail and people repeatedly drive, after they have been under the influence, this is really the last effort that can protect the public, and that's taking their cars away from them. We've been working, as the testimony has indicated earlier, on a local ordinance in Multnomah County, and we have been working with the City of Portland on that. So we have some proposed amendments that we would offer to allow our area to have an ordinance that will work for us. We've also been in contact, I believe, with Deschutes County, because they're Your county's program is really the model, I think, in the state right now that's proven to really work. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chris Carey with the District Attorney's Office, who's been putting the nuts and bolts of our ordinance together and amendments, and I know he's been in contact with Representative Werbelow's office. Just for the record, I do want to say that I think the two convictions within a three-year period is a very, very narrow scope. And I would urge you to really think hard about that. We support keeping the 10-year time period in. The length of the numbers of times you can drink and drive without getting caught are a lot. And so I think two actual convictions within a three-year time period is a really, really narrow policy on that. Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. I will try to be as brief as possible. I was last in contact with the sponsor's office right before we drove down here and thought that we had support for our proposed amendments, which is what you have in front of you. And I think we may do because these amendments seem to be similar to what came out of the House. There seems to be some confusion on how this actually operates. I will give you a very brief summary. Someone is driving under the influence of intoxicants or they get pulled over, that car is declared a nuisance. It is subject to civil in rem forfeiture. It also is subject to being impounded at the time, right there. So the police officer has the ability to tow that car to a lot. If someone is eligible to participate in the diversion program, meaning if someone has no prior convictions within the last 10 years or has not participated in a diversion program, then they are eligible to enter into a community partnership agreement. That agreement, which is, and the model in this ordinance is almost exactly like that is in Deschutes County, allows that individual to enter into an agreement with the seizing agency. They say, I understand I was operating a vehicle while under the influence. I will not do that again, and in fact, if I do that again, I understand that you can take the vehicle. They pay an administrative towing fee. They get their vehicle back. If that individual is then caught driving again, their vehicle is subject to civil in rem forfeiture. What that means is that means that forfeiture proceedings can be instituted by the local district attorney's office. In Deschutes County, there is actually an attorney that works for the sheriff's office that handles their forfeiture provisions. And the vehicle doesn't immediately get taken. Forfeiture proceedings are instituted under ORS 475A, and you have to file a complaint. People are allowed to have answers. You have to serve notice on everyone. All of the protections that are contained in ORS 475A, which is the umbrella civil forfeiture statute, are afforded to all those individuals. That would be innocent owners if the wife owns the car. It would also provide protection to financial institutions, banks, individuals that own the notes on the car, or if there's money owed.
If it's a joint ownership between the husband and the wife, and the husband is the one with the drinking problem,
There isn't a defense to that, correct?
That is correct, Tony. The affirmative defense, the innocent owner defense in ORS 475A says that you have to not know about this. Meaning you can't use the ostrich defense. You can't stick your head in the sand and pretend you're not aware about that. So if there's someone who's in your family and you know that they have a DUI conviction and you continue to loan them your car, then you are not afforded the protection of what's called the innocent owner defense. And that is a general overview on how this bill works. Right before I'm sorry.
So the car, there's no situation where the car is taken at the time of the stop?
When you say taken, someone gets pulled over for DUI, the car is taken in the sense that the police officer impounds it. They get the car out of the roadway, they tow it to a lot, and the individual has the opportunity to get it back. The distinction which is very important to make is between seizure and forfeiture. Forfeiture has some very important legal ramifications, which is where we are actually moving forward to forfeit that individual's interest in the vehicle. Seizing is simply something that happens many times when someone is driving.
But that's important, the seizing issue, because they're inebriated. We're talking about that situation as opposed to not driving a life without a license protection series. But it would be a minimum of how short a period of time they could seize car configure and they could get that back. But they just can't get that back right away, can they? And give me a layperson's example of how quickly they could get the car back, because I'm trying to figure out if they're still loaded and they get back into the car and they're still there. That's all I'm trying to visualize this thing as a layperson. I'm struggling with that. I mean, I'm sorry, but I am.
No, that's a good point that's been raised. And in fact, a lot of the time the reasons the officers will seize the vehicle is because someone's a 2-0, right. They're going to take them, they may get, in Multnomah County, we used to have a matrix problem, they would go right to their vehicle. It's normally 24 to 72 hours turnaround time. Occasionally there's been times when a spouse or someone has come and says, I need to take my children to school, or that's happened. Okay. And that's also the experience in Deschutes County. I got off the phone with Sheriff Brown before I came here. They have a couple of suggested changes, which I have delineated, which you guys don't have. They're everything that we can live with. They're just semantics. I can tell them now if you want.
We'll probably do is put together a quick work group on.
Okay.
And so you'll be invited to participate in that, and we'll work on this language.
That's an overview of how this works. This operates under the umbrella of ORS 475A, the constitutionality of which has been upheld in the Oregon Appellate Court and the Supreme Court of the United States. I have some specific comments, some comments that were made. You guys may be pressed for time. I also have an answer to your preemption question, if you want to hear that.
Sure.
The preemption is found not in this bill, but it is found in 475A, 0.010, sub 4. And that reads as follows. ORS 475A, and then it names up a couple other sections, does not impair the right of any city or county to enact ordinances providing for forfeiture of property based on conduct that is other conduct than is prohibited conduct as defined in ORS 475A, and then it lists the conduct. So the theory is that local jurisdictions and cities are free to enact subjects of forfeiture that aren't covered under a state law. You know, in Multnomah County, we can do promoting prostitution cases, and then the prostitution cases. Those aren't covered under state law. So that's where the preemption comes from.
Sure, I'm curious if I can ask something. Is that okay?
Yes.
Oh. Multnomah County of Portland, and the issue of impoundment, and you impound a vehicle between the city and the lender, who pays the impoundment?
It's rare. I mean, I've had a couple of instances where I've released it to a lender but most of the time we would require the individuals to whom we're releasing it to reimburse the seizing agency for their costs, whatever that towing and storage. So it's a rare circumstance that the police agency gets stuck with the bill. It's normally the individual claiming.
Well,
the lender would also...
75A, it was the city that has to bear that cost.
475A actually speaks to two provisions. There is one provision that says if a case is declined, the seizing agency shall assume all the costs. The second provision is found later in the statute, and that says unless modified by an agreement, meaning the lender and the city can enter into an agreement to cover some of the costs, and that's what happens the vast majority of time.
And I'm sorry, I didn't write your name down on the witness sheet. Could you give
it to me? Christopher Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, and I didn't interview. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and forfeiture counsel, among other ones up there.
Thank you. My name is Dan Olden, O-L-D-H-A-M. I'm Assistant to Sheriff Nolley up in Multnomah County, and my statements are really simple and clear. We have a number of people out who are convicted of drunk driving, driving under the influence, drugs, other activities, who continue to do this by actually getting their cars back and redriving. A study was done by the Portland Police Bureau several years ago. Reed College did it for them. They, in essence, did research around the country that said, hey, 50% of these folks who are committing these crimes do not recidivate when we start to seize the motor vehicles. Other people, brothers, wives, sisters, etc., relatives, don't have a tendency to lend them their car anymore. It's really a big issue for us.
I know it's been very successful in Chief County.
It's been very successful. Yes, it has been. And as a law enforcement agency, this is a tool which really helps us to get these guys off the road and keep them off the road.
Question.
There isn't a jurisdiction problem. You've got Multnomah County and a lot of cities that you don't get into a
turf
battle, but the city police support them.
No, not at all. The city has had a tow program for a number of times. We're currently working with the city, the Portland Police Bureau. I expected them to be here today, Sergeant Pat Kelly. Sergeant Pat Kelly.
Other cities within Multnomah County that have this type of ordinance as well?
The Sheriff's Office, all of the cities in the county have agreed to have the Sheriff's Office administer the program for the smaller cities. Portland will continue, of course, to do theirs. We will do it for Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, Maywood Park, and the unincorporated area of the county. We're already in agreement with that. In fact, we had been writing a county ordinance when we found out about Senator Wilbur's efforts, and we've been trying to make that happen with her.
Senator Chief County, do you do it all for all the cities within your state?
Yes, they do. And in fact, Sheriff Brown, Rick Brown from Deschutes County, came over and helped us to write our ordinance.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riverlisle. And Pat Kelly, did you want to offer your testimony also? All right. Well, good. That's helpful. And I'll invite Ken Sherman also to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. I'm not sure all that was said while I was gone. Excuse me.
He wants to know who won the vote on the motorcycle helmet.
That's what I want to know.
What do you think?
I see Jeffrey's indicating it was passed.
Did pass.
Chair. How did you vote, Representative?
I always vote for it. You know I worked in the emergency room for years. You have to vote against
it. You voted against it?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear
that. My mind is so confused out here. Back to what we were talking about. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure all that went on after I left, but a couple of comments. You mentioned a work group, and I certainly have no problem with the work group, but I would add that the work group should have representatives from Lincoln County, from Deschutes County. I don't, with all due respect to Multnomah County, my two daughters happen to live in that area, but I don't think that we should automatically adopt what they say as the best bill. And as I said, I modeled mine in Deschutes County because it had been the one that was existing the most, the longest, I'm sorry. Multnomah County and also Portland had the opportunity to be there at the table. We had ongoing conversations for 4 or 5 months. And in fact, as I had a telephone conversation with former Representative Nato, and I guess the thing that I'm mainly concerned about is the last minute. And I certainly hope they could put together a work group that I don't want to lose this bill. This bill is very, very important. And unfortunately, the person who came to me originally with the idea was unable to be here. She has come up on 3 other occasions and testified before the House. But I just briefly tell you, she was a college student, an honor student, was hit by a drunk driver who had a prior history of drunk driving, and she had severe neurological damage, and the family, there was an extensive time and money and effort, and it's a miracle Angela is where she is now. Yeah, that she's come that far, but believe me, she will never get to where she is.
Yeah.
Also, in the same thing in Jackson County, a young 9-year-old boy was on a bicycle, was struck and killed by somebody else who had a history of drunk driving. We really need to address this issue in a more direct way than I think we have in the past, and that is to take away the instrument of their harm. And we try to do that, and I can't begin to tell you the different groups that come from us from different ways. We first tied it to conviction, period, and then everybody started calling us and said, we can't do 475 civil in rem. It's too tied to conviction. It would be criminal forfeiture, and we can't do it. So we went back and looked at that again. Although we do have it tied, just like the Chiefs County, too, because if you read the bill, one of the things is that they have been convicted of or forfeited bail or security in there. Again, this is followed pretty much after the Deschutes County with a few small exceptions. So if we do meet in a work group and Multnomah County wants to bring its ideas forward, I certainly want the Deschutes in Lincoln County if they can be. I think they need to be. They have existing successful programs.
Yeah. There are 33 other counties.
The other ones don't have them.
Okay.
And they don't because some of them have been advised until you have the statutory authority to do it in REM.
Specific.
You're at a risk in doing it other than through the criminal forfeiture.
Some people look at 475 as just tied to drug forfeiture, which I think is broader than that, but there, some counties are very reluctant to move forward.
Well, let's hear from the bank. Sherman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. There's some deja vu involved in this for me. I've been representing the association since 1977, and for at least half those years, the subject of civil forfeiture has been an important topic on our table. We go way back to the initial adoption of 475, which was initially adopted as a temporary law, and then finally the sunset was removed, and spent hundreds of hours in tables, around tables in this building, working with Pete Shepard, with your committee counsel, and many others, all of whom had interest in this subject. And I think that 475, which is the product of those, 475A, which is the product of those efforts, has stood the test of time well. It was crafted and continues to exist for a limited purpose to deal with the forfeiture of property that's related to drug activity. And we have continuously maintained through and since that process that we had no objection from our financial industry standpoint to the expansion of the civil forfeiture concept to other forms of inappropriate behavior. And in fact, after a couple of sessions after 475A became law, there were bills in at least 2 sessions of this legislature to expand civil forfeiture to DUI. Those bills faltered because the sponsors of those bills were unwilling to fit them within the very carefully crafted rules of 475A. And from our standpoint, one of the places where they fell down, those later legislative efforts, was on the question of who would pay the costs of seizure and towing and storage and so forth related to the forfeiture if, in fact, the vehicle were released either to the owner or to a security interest holder. And we steadfastly maintained that we ought to follow the carefully crafted rules set out in 475A. Those earlier bills departed from that principle. This bill departs from that principle, and on that basis, we have a real problem with it. We do not, however, oppose the basic concept, and I think we all share the very serious concerns about the impacts that people who drive vehicles in an inebriated state on a repeated basis cause for the people of Oregon. So that's not really an issue here. Our concerns are, I think, technical with the bill in terms of its provisions. If you look at Section 2, which mandates forfeiture under certain circumstances, we don't really have any problem with that. Section 4 says that if there's to be forfeiture under those circumstances, that is to happen in accordance with the provisions set forth in 475A. And frankly, if that was the whole bill, I wouldn't be at this table. But then we get Section 3 and 5, which frankly, I listened to the testimony that has been offered to you this afternoon. I've read the bill several times. And I can't understand yet the interplay between Section 2 on the one hand, which says the forfeiture is mandatory, and Section 3, which seems to suggest that the vehicle may be impounded, and then somebody is going to make a decision about whether or not there will be forfeiture. It seems to me that there is an inherent conflict there, and maybe I'm just not smart enough to figure out how you work around that. But Section 3 goes on to say that if you go through the forfeiture or you're looking at the release of the vehicle, you may be releasing it to someone who has an interest, which would include a financial institution, and then they've got to enter into this vehicle release agreement, the provisions of which don't fit a financial institution. They're not crafted to fit a financial institution. They fit only the owner and the operator of the vehicle. Frankly, it's just not well crafted to deal with that situation. And so our concern is with the mechanics of the bill and not getting caught up in having a law which is inconsistent with the carefully considered forfeiture provisions that are already a part of our law. I think that the simple solution for this problem, if you perceive it to be a problem, is simply to broaden the definition in 475A of what constitutes prohibited conduct. If you did that, then forfeiture under those 475A provisions could be affected for this conduct, and we would have no problem with that. Thank you.
Senator Cornyn, did you testify, Ken, in front of the Senate, I think, representing the Maddox Committee?
Or Shetterly's Committee?
Oh, excuse me, Shetterly's.
I don't believe I did. No,
so
I did not.
This is the first time the issues of the bank has been brought forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the confusion is over what the word shall on line 6 and page 1 and the line and the word may on line 2 and page 2. Is that what it's all about?
So that's the first part of it. I mean, if you want to get into the release agreement, it says in paragraph 9, I'm looking at lines 23 through 28 on page 3 of the bill, that the potential claimant, read that bank, shall pay the amount of administrative costs, shall pay the cost of towing and storage. Completely inconsistent with 475A. Now, does 475A preempt this? I don't think so, because if you read lines 20 and 21 on page 2, it says all forfeiture proceedings under Section 2 shall be conducted in accordance with 475A.
And
it doesn't say under this Act. So It's really hard to know what you're getting here, but I don't think you're getting a product that meshes well with 475A, and you're not getting a product that we can support.
May I respond to that,
yeah.
Chair? The concern was that was raised by the public safety official of the state police is cost. When we talked about 475, they felt that given the limited funds they have, they did not have the money to pay for impounding and so forth. So we had to look to somebody else. It was also recognized that these vehicle forfeitures are much different than forfeitures that happen under 475 in the sense of the value. In fact, as many of these vehicles may even be beaters or, you know, worth very little, where under the drug forfeiture type of thing, you can have, be having quite valuable assets. And so how you pay for something isn't a big question like it is when you're talking about these vehicles. And so we did a balance and said, if somebody wants to get this car out of impoundment, and we recognize three categories, people could, a lien holder, the owner, or the co-owner, that the burden would be on them to pay that cost. Because otherwise, especially the state police did not feel like they could support the bill. They wanted it. But
of course, if it's a beater, depending on what they get, there probably wouldn't be a financial institution involved in. If they hold the car and sell it, they're only going to get a minimum auction price anyway, so they probably take a financial beating on it anyway.
That's true, but they thought they'd come out better overall if they had. And that was taking them into consideration, the cost.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, cost was exactly the issue on which we high centered in the earlier efforts. And I think the legislature declined to enact the earlier legislation on this same subject precisely because they felt it was unfair to levy what amounts to a special tax on financial institutions and others who hold security interests. We're talking about enforcement of the criminal laws, and that is a cost which is historically carried by the whole public and not imposed on any one operator. I don't have any problem, I mean, my bankers don't have any problem, if you want to craft a bill that says if the release is to be made back to the vehicle owner operator, that he, she must pay those costs. That's not a problem. But don't dump those costs on the bank just because the state police don't have enough money to carry out the program. We fought that battle to a standstill in the earlier legislation. We ought not to go through it again.
Thank you, Jeff. Other questions? We will then close the public hearing on this matter, and I've asked that Senator Courtney to head a work group to.
I want Tarno with me.
All right, and he has a special request for Senator Tarno. Hold the search and seizure and forfeiture of Senator Tarno.
Oh, yeah.
He'll join you on this.
The cop. He's a Republican. He's from rural Oregon.
He's a good guy.
He owes.
And he thinks it's a good bill.
He owes.
I do, Judy.
We're next for the public hearing on 2801 and invite Representative Cruz and it.
You don't mind being on that video.
Good. I could help it. I think it would be a good thing here.
You should continue to follow 35A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for scheduling this hearing on this bill. Be as brief as possible. There's a lot to this bill, but we'll try to keep our comments short. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Representative, District 51. This bill, 2801, comes to you actually from a cattleman in my district who didn't have much of an interest in politics or politicians, but he said if I was a politician for 5 minutes, I would introduce this bill. From that, from his idea, with some much heavy lifting,
pretty quickly smart.
Much heavy lifting, we bring it to you in this form. What this bill does is it simply provides another option to posting private property. This bill is very popular. In fact, some of the language that you see before you is lifted directly from a Montana statute that also allows for the posting of private property to be done in this manner. The Montana law is a little bit more restrictive than what we have done, but nonetheless, this allows the top 6 inches, at least in our bill, to be spray painted orange, which would signify as a sign or a instead of a sign, as a signal of being private property. While the bill it takes a minute for it to grow on you, perhaps, but any of you that hunt or fish, which is really the reason that this is brought to you, know that oftentimes private property signs are taken off of those fences, especially in open range lands where there is expansive private property, and you have a very difficult time of keeping private property posted as such. So what this bill simply does is it adds another option of posting.
the amendments that you have before you today, we went through several, many work sessions on this bill, and were able to get the bill in a good enough shape where it passed the House 49-10 with one excuse. That one excuse was my 50th vote. But in the changes, we left out one of the amendments, in which I bring to you today in the dash A5, which says if your favorite fishing hole is federal property or it's not your property and you mark it that it is your property, we have created some language here for unlawful posting under this bill. Without going into too much detail, I brought to you today Farm Bureau, brought together someone who has suffered through, and as a courtesy to me, would suffer through one more hearing, Representative Cruz. Also, this has some help from the cattlemen, small woodland resource owners, Oregonians in Action, and Cunningham Sheep and Cattle Company, as well as a whole host of others. So that is what it does. Legally, what we have done is we've created a third-degree offense of trespass, which is a little bit lower than what is on the books right now. There's several reasons for that. One of all, without going through and changing all of the language that was there already, we found that to be a major hurdle, so we created a third offense, a third degree offense. Also, there is an education side to this. If you all recall, when the sign came out that had a cigarette with a circle with an X through it, it took a while for society to know that that meant no smoking. You know, another example I was talking with Representative Mannix about is the fact that all the signs on the highway in highways in Europe are now signs that, regardless of language, we recognize what the sign means. There is an educational element to realizing what an orange fence post in Eastern Oregon means no trespassing, or means private property. So with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague.
If I could ask one question, and either one of you can address this. Currently, criminal trespass in the second degree is a Class C misdemeanor, which is a higher penalty than what you're proposing in your criminal trespass 3. And it states the person commits a crime of criminal trespass in the second degree if the person enters on or remains unlawfully in or upon premises. In the scenario you gave, wouldn't that already cover your situation and have a higher penalty than what the bill would attempt to do?
Senator Bryant, under the example that I gave, perhaps. And the reason I say it that way is that we found in writing the bill, and I'll have representatives from Farm Bureau here answer more specifically, we found that we had to create the third degree measure in order not to go back and keep changing. I've said that very sloppily. Let me allow Mr. Vernassa to continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasek, an attorney with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I think one of the reasons that we crafted a criminal trespass in the third degree is to get around the intent requirement of the misdemeanor provision in the criminal trespass in the second degree. As a violation, there is no intent requirement that needs to be proved for a prosecutor in whatever county in Oregon to bring forward these charges. And frankly, that's one of the problems that we've seen with the criminal trespass in the second degree, is that because of difficulty in proving even the minimal, most minimal criminal negligence, having that burden in place, a lot of prosecutors are refusing to go forward with these types of claims. And the thought is, if we post land with either trespass notices or with the blaze signing that Representative Atkinson has talked about, and an individual still trespasses on that property, there might be a higher likelihood of actual prosecution and addressing the issues in an effective manner that are not being handled today, which is one of the prime reasons that I believe to come forward and why Farm Bureau fully supports this bill.
Do you think by adopting this we would anyway lessen the district attorney's authority to move forward with a trespass 2 charge if it were appropriate?
Mr. Chair, again, Tim Bernasek. I will tell you, first of all, I'm not an expert in criminal law, although some of the bills that we've introduced this session have been described as criminal.
I'm sure
you got that right.
I don't know what impact that would have on the prosecutor. I believe they still have the same discretion as they do today to prosecute these crimes. I think it's a much more workable solution that Representative Atkinson has come up with and we fully support it. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, State Representative, District 45. My colleague asked me to come here today and tell you that he's a really nice guy. And
this is his take home, really.
Yeah. I did question his judgment on choice. Yeah. I would also say, Mr. Chair, that 25-25 passed today, too. You might be interested in that.
I would be.
I see if I might.
Took you long enough.
We are slow, but we do it right.
It's helping you a lot here, Jason.
You're trying to sort out of the straw here.
Yeah, I know. Like lawyers.
Good job on that.
Thank you for helping
us. Yeah, I appreciate the help on that.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. We try to cover you, too. So, now, basic.
This is becoming so expensive.
It was an entertaining process we went through for a freshman legislator who had a bill that was a really great idea that everybody liked on the very front end of it, and then we would get to a point and it would melt down, and then we'd get back up and then melt down, and I praised the representative for surviving his first time through the meat grinder, and in reality we have come up with a very good product here that I think over time is going to allow both landowners and those who are confused as to where they are to know when they're trespassing and when they're not. You get out in Eastern Oregon and you go for miles and miles and nothing, and it's sometimes hard to distinguish private land from public land unless there's something to mark. And this is an inexpensive and more permanent way of marking land. Because if you go out and try to post no trespassing signs, the wind blows them off, people tear them off, they shoot them full of holes, and a blaze of paint is a more permanent way to mark.
Sure.
Yes, is the candidate, Governor Goldschmidt, get in trouble for calling Eastern Oregon miles and miles from nothing?
No, he called Bend Oregon. Bend Oregon, the middle of nowhere. Who would want to come to Bend and debate in the middle of nowhere?
I'll do stuff.
In Eastern Oregon, you called miles from nowhere?
Miles of I could say it's beautiful nothing because that's what it is.
Miles of nothing. I just wanted to clarify what you
meant. I was hanging in there, I'm just looking fast.
I would differentiate Central Oregon and Northeastern Oregon from that example.
My wife is from Southeastern Oregon.
And I would Central Oregon is about 100 square foot area right in the center of our state.
I think Sage is beautiful. Representative
Carno. I'm kind of lost too. Didn't Montana or Wyoming adopt a policy of using paint for designating fire property or some of the cases?
It was Montana. Montana, it's been actually researching Bill Clark and people in the Midwest, and I actually talked to them about the merits of the bill, and they said, oh yeah, I like the Montana law. It's with people who travel to Montana to hunt fish, it's widely known. They do it a little bit differently there. They do the entire post, and I wasn't really comfortable with that, so we amended it to be approximately top 6 inches.
Now, this could go on a tree, right?
Correct.
I could be wrong about this, but when my family camps out in their little four-person camp, because in the law of the Tolies, if we can't afford a place to buy gear or something different, it's one of the things. I could swear that we go out scavenging around for firewood, which is illegal. I could swear that some of the trees in that national forest, they spray paint them. Now, they're supposed to see some signal. Maybe they're going to shoot. They're going to cut one down or something. I don't know if they spray paint them orange or not. but the spray paint. So I don't know whether or not you've checked that out, because you could get yourselves into a bit of a confusion here with the feds, the state. And I could be wrong, but I know some things have been sprayed out there.
National Forest for horse cutting mark their trees with paint. And there's orange, blue, and yellow. See,
and the only reason I bring that up in terms of, because you said this is going to take a while to educate, I don't know whether or not, you understand what I'm saying? It might create some confusion, because I don't think they mean it's off limits. But the orange paint does show up, I think you're right, on some of those trees. So I just brought that up for what it's worth, as I'm in that little tent along the river there, cramped in there with other members of my family as well. Others are in Sun River playing golf.
Sure, we have typically bigger family.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, they do mark the trees, but we're talking about marking of the circumference. So it is a different form of marking and very distinguishable from just letter marking on the tree.
No, I understand, but I was going to ask you to call my attention. The good bill that he... I don't know, I just want to make sure that we understand this distinct markings going on here. We can use the blazer. That's all I want to say.
No, actually, in all the listing we did, we've not had that conversation. That is, you know, given the fact that it's a perimeter, but you're right, I think this does fall into the overtime education. The other thing that's often used in the forest is ribbons.
Right.
Ribbons around and ribbons on stakes and whatnot. So you're right.
And we will also see different colors for different timber companies. And so to find a color that's not used may not be practical. So I think the way it's applied is going to be what differentiates it.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Dale, you want to testify on this? What do you got to say about this? You don't go outside the woods ever outside. It ain't here, but I'm curious to know
what. Where about your chairman wrote that down?
And the chairman did.
Yeah.
So he didn't write it down?
No.
You don't have to speak if you don't want to.
Mr. Vice Chair, I'm going to give you a couple of thoughts. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney, and I understand the motivation for this bill, and I hate to throw problems here, but I did meet with committee counsel when this bill was in their committee, and I never appeared in the committee, and it probably was at my urging that they look for some alternative to the original bill of just having the blaze of paint and being a crime of criminal trespass. Because I told them that we must prove a mental element, and I could not see how we would ever be able to prosecute someone for knowing trespass based upon a rock or a tree or a blaze of orange paint someplace on the property line. Now, the bill talks about if you use a sign, it says close to entry and it gives information. But the blaze of paint may be applied to any natural object. And so on the riverway, you can have rocks that would be painted. You could have trees, just a square bit of paint. And the state police were very much concerned with this because they couldn't see that as being enforceable. And I understand the problem, and yet you want to have a bill that will be enforced and will make a difference. So they went to, that was the only contact I had. The next thing I knew, the bill came out and was passed by the House, and it went to this alternative where you are not going to prove a mens rea. That means this is a strict liability crime. It doesn't matter whether you knew it or should have known it or didn't care about knowing it. There is no mens rea element. And so if you cross a line where there was some orange paint, you've trespassed and you're liable to be prosecuted for a violation trespass. Now, perhaps there are ways that this can be done where perhaps as part of a driver's license, anyone who gets a driver's license, they would learn about the signs that orange paint means no trespassing, and if you get a hunting license and a fishing license, and maybe that would help this issue, but it is a concern.
about how are people really going to know that that means no trespassing. Whereas I understand the property owner, he or she is feeling secure that I've got my rocks out there, or I've got my fence posts, or I've got my tree stands, and no one will trespass on my land anymore. But is that really going to happen? The other issue is the issue that the chair brought up with the question. I am concerned that with this third degree trespass, that we would be foreclosed from filing second degree trespass, because certainly we would want to prosecute the repeat offender. Because there we do have the ability to prove notice. Maybe they didn't know the first time, but now we've got an officer that said, hey, I arrested them the first time, or I gave them a citation, and I told them, I showed them the property line, and now the guy's back a second time, or a third time. We have, in effect, the same statutory language here, and we may run into an issue that we are foreclosed from charging second-degree misdemeanor trespass with a third degree. Having said those things, I understand there is a problem here, and I wish there was an easy way to address it. But those are the issues.
Mr. Chair? Yes, sir. Deal under criminal law, does the person who owns property have to post that property before you have a trespass issue?
Well, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Tarno, for us to really prove, to prosecute the case, yes. And that's always our recommendation. We tell people, put a sign, conspicuous, give notice, and that's what we'd recommend.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at 164.243. It doesn't say you have to post it. And 245, which is second degree trespass. It doesn't say it's supposed to be. It doesn't say you're supposed to be trespassing.
Yeah. And Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Tarno, I agree. There is no statutory duty to post. However, the advice that the police agency is going to give when you call and say, I want you to arrest this person for trespass is, well, what notice do they have? And so that's why when you park downtown here in a restaurant, you're going to see those signs that says no trespassing after such and such hour. But it's a requirement that since we are going to need to prove knowledge in trespass, we are always going to give that advice to people. You need to have a sign, and we have to have some way of proving knowledge for us to file that. And that's kind of how this all got moving to the violation way, I'm sure.
I'm concerned that either Elephant Atkinson or Fred Cruz are here, because I think they need to hear what you had to say and don't really want to say. But in terms of the paint, it seems to me that we've done a good job of refining developing symbols, i.e. like the women's restroom or men's restroom. Isn't there some way to develop a symbol that would simply mean miss trespassing, and that granted it would take longer than 2 years for it to become common knowledge, but like a stop sign is a pretty common symbol even without the word stop in it, most people recognize that. Couldn't we do the same thing here, have it be a triangle or something along those lines?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I must say, I was not at the hearings. I was just at a work group with committee counsel, and I raised these issues, and that's when it went off a different way. I thought they were going to give up on trespass, quite frankly, after my meeting with committee counsel.
Okay.
But I assume they've tried to discuss those alternatives and haven't been able to come up with one.
Does the violation eliminate the mens rea requirements? I'm sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is why they've gone to the violation, so that it is, in effect, a strict liability violation, not a crime, but as a violation. So
if you were mistakenly, then refined correctly, whatnot, and went past the sign, you could be held responsible up to or affect the downtown.
Mr. Chair, if you walk by a block of orange paint on a rock or a tree, and that was the concern.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I'm looking at this bill,
I have to answer them, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Penn, as I was reading this bill, I wondered if there might be sort of a proportionality paradox, meaning that, for example, there is a fairly specific list of requirements for posting, and there are some alternatives in the bill. If a person posted notice, that's the $500 of the bill, and then a personal trespass, that would be criminal trespass $300 of the bill. It appears to me that then, because the specific overrules the general, that that person, even with knowledge, probably could not be prosecuted under criminal trespass too. However, if the person posting notice didn't quite meet the requirements required under the bill, did something a little bit less, we wouldn't be able to, or rather the prosecution would not be able to prove criminal trespass three, but could prove criminal trespass two, which would be a proportionality paradox. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Horton, yes. That's what I was trying to say, is that it would create problems in both of these statutes, and we could, in effect, be prevented from filing either one. And then the repeat offender, we'd have this problem. I do think it would be great if they had closed the entry in orange, which is the one way of posting a sign. Then we can prove knowledge, somebody walking past that one. But it is a difficulty, I understand, but we're real concerned about this coming in our criminal justice system and accomplishing what the proponents want it to accomplish.
It is regrettable that they're not here to hear your testimony. Mm-hmm. I have an assignment for you. Could you do it so tactfully, would you mind talking to them about your testimony and what your concerns were?
Certainly.
And we won't go into work session on this. All right. Anyone else sign up on this bill?
Good afternoon, Chairman Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, and I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. This has been an interesting discussion, and we haven't been real involved in this bill, although so far, but we do support the concept. Trespassing, I think it's a really valid bill. There might be a few issues that we need to sort out. This issue of whether it will prohibit DAs from prosecuting under criminal trespass 2 is a valid point, and something, quite frankly, I don't practice criminal law. I don't know if I have a real solid grip on, but I'd like to discuss that further and try to fix any problem that occurs there. But trespass is becoming more of a problem all the time. It's a negative thing. Not only do landowners need the ability to control what happens on their property, they have a right to do that, there's personal injury liability issues, there's fire danger now that we have more federal and state programs with regard to providing for habitat, which results in increased dry grasses and other habitat that serves as more fire hazard. We also have a lot of other environmental issues. Now that we have critical habitat and sensitive habitat along our streams and in other areas and meadows and whatnot that landowners are responsible to maintain, when trespassing occurs, at times it can bring additional environmental liability nowadays on landowners. So the trespass issue is something that we will need to deal with. And as we hear from landowners, these trespass claims are not being prosecuted. It's difficult because we have to prove that the person that trespassed was knowledgeable, knowingly, or should have known that they were on property that wasn't theirs. Some excuses that people have are very valid, and other excuses are not. And so the bill would establish a violation, which is different than the misdemeanor, as far as I've been told. I'm not an expert on this criminal law issue, but a violation that would not require the proof of a mental state of mind that they had knowledge or should have known. But there's kind of a trade-off here. We do have additional burden on the public that there is this violation if this bill passes, where a mental state would not have to be proven. But on the other hand, it's a lesser offense. It's not a misdemeanor. It's up to $1,000 penalty, and I've been told from DAs throughout, you know, Eastern Oregon that generally we could count on that being reduced to $400 or $500 most of the time. So it's not a huge penalty. And then the additional posting requirements on landowners. If you're going to have a violation that has a lesser degree of mental state required to prove it, then you have additional burden on landowners to make sure that the public knows where the property lines are and what is public property, what is private property, and where they can go and where they should stay at it. So it is a give and take, and I think that the concept is good. It's a good balance. I really recommend that we take a further serious look at this bill and try to work out any problems. Thank you.
Yes, it sounds to me like you think it's really important for both the property owners and the public to have a clear understanding of what the property boundaries are, is that right?
Yes, well, Senator Brown, I think that's true. What is happening now, what I've been told that DAs use for the for first and second degree criminal trespass is, Senator Trano is correct in that there's no posting requirements right now, but I've been told that DAs use other indications of property ownership, such as posting with a sign, such as fencing, or such as crops. If a person is trespassing in an area, such as large dry land wheat fields that seem to go on forever, that person should have knowledge that that property is privately owned, and there's a crop there being grown by someone, and if they don't have permission, they shouldn't be in there. So I think it is important for the public to have a right to know what private property is and what public property is. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish. But there are a lot of indicators used out there other than posting no trespass signs.
Thanks.
Other comments? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll then close the public hearing on... Oh, we have someone else ready to include the board. We'll open the public hearing again on 2801.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Terry Lammers. I'm the State Issues Coordinator with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and also I'm a woodland owner in Polk County. The Oregon Small Woodlands Association supports this bill, and one of the main reasons why we support it is because no trespassing signs tend to disappear in the forest. I've put up hundreds of no trespassing signs, and you could go out 2 years later and you'd be lucky to find more than 25% of them. And so I don't know if it's an organized attempt to take down signs or what, but I believe someone is taking them down, and then the person who comes along at a later date legitimately might not know that they're trespassing, even though there's a fence. To my knowledge, I don't think painted signs or painted trees and heavy painted rocks can be removed. And that's one of the major reasons why we support this bill. It may have some problems. I'd like to see those worked out. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? This question for the council, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
A violation only has a fine of $500. How can I go to $1,000? Is that just, can you just do that?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carno, under current law, violations have a limit of $250. And if that statute is not withstood, notwithstanding the statute that provides for that, then a violation can generally be any amount.
Okay.
The reason I asked Jane the person about the notification is we still have unresolved again this session the whole issue of the public's right to use the beds and banks of our navigable waterways, and I guess I'm not very excited about supporting a bill requiring strict liability in terms of trespassing to resolve that particular issue. So I know that's a whole different can of worms, but I'm real concerned here. As she started talking, it raised some questions in my mind about that issue, and until that's resolved, I'm not excited about going here.
I would really need.
That issue probably won't be resolved for 100 years. Other comments on 2801? Other witnesses? Seeing none, then we'll close the public hearing 2801, open a public hearing on House Bill 3295, and call Joel Shapiro and Ingrid Quincy. And Dale Penn.
Yeah.
And Mr. Shapiro, the committee has received your written testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
first like to say hello to Senator Brown. The last time we saw each other, we were in sleeker and perhaps more comfortable clothing.
That's correct.
Do you beg your pardon?
Do you like an explanation or anything?
What was that?
I'm going to be excused from the team.
Don't you want to be coward?
I'll let you explain.
We were both doing our part in biking to work.
Okay.
In Portland. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just briefly give you a summary of how this legislation came about and what it purports to do. I am a third-year law student at Lewis and Clark Law School. I'm also formerly an intern with the U.S. Attorney's Office and currently an intern with the District Attorney's Office in Multnomah County. Through my work experience as well as my academic experience, I've been involved with the domestic violence advocacy community in Multnomah County and across the state through the U.S. Attorney's Office. In doing research into this issue, into the dynamics of domestic violence prosecution, it became clear to me that there's a real problem with the admissibility of evidence that is without a doubt reliable evidence and would otherwise be admissible evidence, but under the narrowness of the various hearsay exceptions is unable to come in. And through that research, I drafted the initial draft of this legislation. I worked with one of my professors, Doug Belushi, testified before the House Committee. He's unable to be here today. I worked with Professor Belushi, the advocates, the Oregon Department of Justice, and members of the District Attorney Association, including Mr. Perrin, his representative, to come up with the version which you have before you today. What this bill purports to do is make sure that the prosecution that deal with domestic violence are done based on evidence that is the most reliable. It attempts to bring the Oregon Evidence Code really into line with reality, because we know that what happens in many cases, by the time it reaches the trial stage, that the victim has reconciled with the assailant, whether it's out of coercion or free volition. Many times this has happened, and the statement that she gives closer to the trial conflicts with her earlier statement. Under the hearsay rules, normally a statement that is closer in time to an incident is presumed to be more reliable. In this case, that earlier statement would be excluded, and there would not be a way to admit it at trial for substantive purposes. What this bill will do is they will look at the entire picture and to see is there corroborating physical evidence and do a more searching inquiry into the surroundings and making the statement itself and deciding whether it would be admissible. With that, I'll conclude my comments.
Is it and the part of the bill that would allow the police officer to testify to what the victim said, even if the victim doesn't show up, or putting the evidence tape recording to the victim's statements, again, if the victim doesn't show up? So there's no right to cross-examination.
No.
Because the victim's not there.
Mr. Chairman, there would be an opportunity to cross-examine the proponent of the evidence, which in that case would be the police officer who heard the statement.
But you don't have the opportunity to cross-examine the person who made the statement.
That is correct.
So doesn't that violate your constitutional right of confrontation?
Mr. Chairman, that is an issue that Professor Belushi addressed on the House side, and I will try to explain it. But if a hearsay exception is deemed to be firmly rooted, it means that it satisfies a historically recognized hearsay exception, that the reliability of the statement in and of itself satisfies the confrontation issues which are at root addressing the same concerns legally.
But you don't have the right to cross-examine the victim because the victim's not there to testify.
That's true, nor do you in many of the hearsay, in all of the hearsay exceptions. But
here there is a victim there. Would this only be used where you subpoena the victim and the victim refuses to come?
This would, let's see,
and correct me if I'm wrong, probably the temp could also subpoena the victim.
That's true.
And the DA could subpoena.
Again, that's a point that Professor Bullis has spoken on, is that this would create an interesting dynamic in that it would place almost more of an onus on the defense, and, or not an onus, but an incentive on the defense to bring forward the victim if they have recanted their earlier statement. And in many cases, you have, in fact, the opposite of that, where the defense is putting pressure on the victim not to come to court, either through coercion, physical threats, or making it difficult just in terms of practical.
Well, Mr. Penn, wouldn't you subpoena the victim to testify?
Mr. Chair, I believe that this is basically an expansion of the excited utterance hearsay exception, which is actually sub 2 in the evidence code. And in that situation, you do not have a right to cross-examine the utterer of the statement. And that's because of the historical basis of the exception, and that is because the court is analyzing the reliability of the statement itself. This hearsay exception is simply an expansion of excited utterance up to 24 hours. And it applies in domestic violence only. And it's a situation where, and we have worked with the appellate section of DOJ, we believe it is constitutional and it deals with the confrontational issues. But the court must make an individual determination of reliability. And so the court will take into account at the hearing the indicators as listed on page 5 of the bill, section, begin on 5 and then go forward onto page 6 of the bill. And they're going to look at the timing. They're going to look at whether or not this was the result of leading questions. It's going to look at these, but maybe the most important one is there must be independent corroboration of the statement before the court is going to make a determination of reliability. And only after the court has that hearing and is satisfied there is independent corroboration and satisfied on these other indicators, which are classic excited utterance legal issues, then the statement would be admissible. And the chair is right that this is not open to cross-examination, but many of these other exceptions, including excited utterance, is not as well.
And it's been a long time since I've been involved in the evidence questions, but on excited utterance, isn't one of the requirements that the witness not be available in order to use the excited utterance?
Well, Mr. Chair, on the first page of the bill, now this is not anything we're changing, but the excited utterance provision is sub 2, it's line 8. But if we look up above on line 5, even though the declarant is available, and so they may or may not be available, a statement relating to a startling event, that's the excited utterance exception. And we're taking basically that same provision, but confining it to domestic violence and expanding it out to a 24-hour period because of the problem in domestic violence where victims are either unable to make an immediate report or frightened or in other ways prevented from making that immediate report. And so we now use excited utterance extensively in domestic violence cases, but there are a number of cases that this expansion would reach. Our goal is simply to remove the pressure from a victim in a domestic violence situation. Fear, financial concerns about the children, concerns of family pressure, religious pressure, all types of pressures are put on domestic violence victims not to report. And even if they do report, because the violence has gotten to such a degree that they do call on a 911 call, then at the time of trial, there's tremendous pressure on the victim to recant, to go to court and tell them to drop the charge. That happens in almost every case that we prosecute and statewide, where a victim is at our door saying, I want you to dismiss this case.
Our goal is not to rack up convictions. Our goal is to stop the violence and to intervene. And in most situations, there are in effect not diversion programs but deferred sentencing programs that we simply want to have the violence stopped. By expanding the excited utterance hearsay exception, it will allow us to intervene in a larger number of cases and give the message to the offender that putting pressure on the victim, forcing the victim to recant or to testify untruthfully in court, is not going to save you from responsibility from the violence. The violence must stop. That is really the basis of this bill. I'll simply say it passed the House in a 53-1 vote. The District Attorney Association strongly supports this bill. The Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence strongly supports this bill. As we said, we see it as an ability to take that pressure off of victims. With the requirement of the court seeing corroboration and the hearing itself, we believe that it fits precisely in the hearsay exceptions and is a small expansion of the excited utterance rule.
One question on the impeachment portion of it.
Yes.
I understand using the prior inconsistent statements for impeachment. But normally that's not substantive.
Yes.
Does this bill make it substantive?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There's three things this bill does. There is the expansion of the excited utterance hearsay exception, which we discussed, 24 hours. There is the identification that impeachment evidence is substantive evidence, so that a jury may listen to a proposal that is given by the victim, because we know that victims come and appear for the abuser and will say, well, I slipped and fell. But the jury will be able to listen to all of the evidence, including the medical testimony, and if they decide that, based upon all the evidence, the truth is that this was not a slip and fall, but this was a smashed fist to the eye, which is what the victim told the doctor, or made an excited utterance, which is admissible, if they believe that's the truth, they can act upon that and avert it. That's the reason of requiring substantive evidence, because without that provision, even if they believe it's true, they must have substantive evidence of that information to be able to justify a verdict. The third thing that it does is it looks rather complicated, but it is an amendment to the child witness hearsay exception. And this is section 18 on page 3, no, excuse me, this is section 18B on page 3 and 4. And what this is designed to get at is, you know, last session you passed a bill that said that if a child witnesses domestic violence, that domestic violence crime becomes a felony. And we know the tremendous impact on children by witnessing domestic violence. We have the problem that the hearsay exception for children applies to the victim only. And in domestic violence, normally the victim is the mother of the children, and so the child witness will not be able to use the hearsay exception here, because they are not, quote, the victim. They are a witness. And this just simply expands it to say that they are a witness, a child witness. So either a brother of a child witnesses that abuse, or the children of the mother witness the abuse. The court still goes through an analysis of, is this appropriate? But that's the slight expansion there.
Senator Brown.
I guess my question, Dale, is my understanding is fairly frequently in Multnomah County, they're using the excited utterance process to avoid even having the victim testify in these cases. So why then is this extra step necessary?
Well, Senator Brown, I don't know what I'm supposed to say since the chair and vice chair. Chair and Senator Brown. Our goal would be to not involve the victim if that's not necessary. We simply advise the victim the case is going, and if you want to appear, you can, but not to force, in effect, putting more pressure on the victim when they're already operating under threats and fear and that concern. And so that's our goal in trying to expand this out. We do use excited utterances, and in Multnomah County, they use excited utterances. This would simply expand it out a little bit farther out to 24 hours. Most excited utterances are within a few minutes to within an hour or so of the event. This would take it out to 24 hours.
Thank you. I think the Vice Chair didn't really want to.
No, I'm speaking that I'd like Ingrid to join me.
I'd like to ask a question if I might.
Sure.
It may be pertinent, it may not.
Mr. Vice Chair, if I may add to Senator Brown's answer.
Are you asking me if you can, or are you just going to do it?
I'm asking you if I may.
Well, you just go ahead and do it.
Okay.
I'm full service, not all of them.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Brown. The other reason for this is that there are many instances where the victim is not in what would be considered an excited state when she makes her utterance. So what this does is say, rather than using a possibly arbitrary standard, was the person, the declarant, excited at the time? Maybe she's withdrawn, maybe she's, you know, catatonic or something. She makes a statement, and so you use other indicia of reliability rather than just excitedness to get a more balanced picture, a more reliable picture of what this statement is reliable.
Very good. Thanks.
Senator Tano.
I just want to know if a spontaneous declaration is the same thing as an excited utterance. Or what is it? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Tano, it is not. It is slightly different. I won't go into all the details.
You'll have to do on this one.
Okay, Ingrid, would you please tell us why you hate the bill?
Ingrid Swenson, Criminal Defense Fund Association. The X is in the right place. And I think it's, first of all, interesting that we've been sitting here listening to victims' rights for a couple of weeks now, and we're talking here about crime victims, but we're talking about the prosecutor making decisions on their behalf, making decisions to go forward even when they tell them they don't want to go forward, making decisions to use their statements even though they tell them those statements are lies and that was not the truth, and I don't want you to use my statements which were made at a time when I was angry and which I didn't mean. So it's just an interesting concept. Secondly, I've heard from Mr. Penn that these are all, I think he called them all slight expansions. Well, I think they are all enormous changes in the criminal law of the state and the evidence which applies in criminal cases. They have very big implications for the prosecution of their cases. There are the three separate pieces of this measure, and the first two basically require that the victim be there, and if the victim is there, then these statements will be used or can be used despite the witness's current statements, which is contrary to the earlier statement. And basically, we heard about why these are so reliable, but all they amount to is a contemporaneous statement of the witness. That does not, in and of itself, make it reliable. A person can make a wrong statement at any time, can make a false statement at any time. The excited utterance provision, which is the last of the three changes, is quite a different matter because it assumes that a person says something in such an excited state that they haven't had time to reflect and to say, what would be in my interest and what would serve my purposes? Now, let's see, I called the police because we had an argument. Well, I want him to go to jail. So I know, because I've been through this restraining order business, I know that if I say he hit me, they got to arrest him, and they won't arrest me, even though he might claim that I'm the instigator of all of this. So a person does have time within 24 hours, that's for sure, to think about these things and reflect on them. So it's quite a different manner from the excited utterance, which happens, it just comes out of your mouth, and it's admissible because it's assumed that you didn't have time to think about those things. In terms of the reliability of these statements, you haven't heard this testimony with respect to any bill discussion, but the restraining order process can be and is abused in my county and probably in every other county. It also has wonderful uses, and it can serve as a good protection for victims of violence. But I have represented members of couples where there are 20 alleged violations of cross-restraining orders, and it's just a contest of who's going to call the police first and say, she called me, no, he called me, well, she told me to call her. And that process can most definitely be abused. I was in a case this very morning in Multnomah County where the judge found that both parties had manipulated and used the restraining order process, and she threw both their restraining orders out because they both had reasons to lie about the conduct of the other. So I don't think we should assume that the statement that a witness makes after an argument, after a confrontation, even though it's to a police officer, is reliable and very truthful. There wasn't much discussion of the confrontation right, and I think it is a sophisticated analysis. It's not necessarily a simple one, because some kinds of hearsay statements are admissible even though you don't have the person there in front of you, which is apparently required under the United States Constitution and also under the Oregon Constitution, which gives you the right to have the witness there in court so you can cross-examine them. But when the court finds an exception, it has to have a good reason, and reliability is not enough in and of itself. That's not good enough. You have to have a well-established exception to the hearsay rule before the court is going to find that your confrontation right is not violated. So I think that's part of the analysis here. With respect to the provision which appears on line 20 of page 3 of the A. and Gross bill that Mr. Penn was talking about in terms of the cases involving children, unfortunately the language is not as limited as the situation that he described, because basically it says that a statement made by a person concerning an act of abuse, that can be an adult victim. It doesn't just apply to an adult witness to an act of abuse against a child, because the section that it refers to talks about intrafamilial abuse, which can include adults as well as children, and it includes sex trafficking. So technically, under this exception, if a man were charged with raping his girlfriend or his wife, this would allow that kind of hearsay to come in a rape case. On its face, it appears to authorize that. Finally, with respect to the last exception to the hearsay rule, which is set forth on page 5, it does set forth some requirements for reliability, and so it's a little different from the other exceptions. I noticed that there's no provision for prior notice to the defendant, as there is in 27A, which is the residual exception to the hearsay rule, so that a party will give an advance notice of the other party's intent to use this language. And again, I think I just need to reiterate that it is not comparable to the cited utterance provision, and basically it's swallowed the rule.
Mr. Vice Chair, could I correct just a couple of things?
Are there any questions of the witnesses?
Can I
make some corrections, you say?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'm very concerned that the committee not be confused that the provision about the child witness is in some way an expanded hearsay exception that involves adults. On page 4 at line 29 of the bill, when it talks about the child witness part of this bill, it says this subsection applies to a child declarant
for an adult declarant with developmental disabilities. This is only designed with someone who is a child under the age of 12 or their mental age is to the point that their ability to express themselves is very minimal. That this is very clear. This is not designed to deal with adults who are mentally operating as adults. The other thing that I'd want to emphasize on the hearsay expansion on page 5, again, this is one of the few hearsay exceptions that we've built in the idea that there must be independent corroboration. And that is there on page 5, line 45, independent corroboration. And that is something the court is going to have to review and make a determination about.
Thank you.
May I make a question? comment, if I might, Mr. Vice Chair. I think, frankly, that there's a conflict between the language on page 3, lines 20 to 25, and the language that Mr. Penn is pointing to on line 29, because it clearly applies to a person, whether or not the person has a developmental disability, if the person is present. The person is required to be present, but it applies only language of class.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the hearing.
Here's a good one.
Public hearing 2278.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes from the Oregon Law Commission, the commission that the legislature created last session to review laws, among other things, law improvement.
Okay.
And this bill is a result of the case of Dunning, the Corrections Facility Siting Authority, where the Oregon Supreme Court and the dealing with the due process statute here said that the law was less than clear. This legislation coming from the Oregon Law Commission would make this process clear. This is actually a technical bill, but it does relate to a very sensitive subject, and that's citizen citing.
There's no one signed up for this bill.
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
This is
typical of a law improvement bill, the fact that
no one shows up.
If you want to come around.
Close the public hearing at 2278.
Want to come
on?
Sure.
Open session, House Bill 2278.
Move 2278.
Senator Vernon Duncan moves House Bill 2278 to floor due pass recommendation. Any objections? Done.
Can I
have this, sir? Senator Duncan, do you want to try prison saying, Karen? Is that too difficult? It's too dangerous. Given that your caucus and where the Republicans are, I'm trying to field another prison. And I don't want you to trouble with certain members of your caucus who want to build a prison every part of the state with their backyard.
I don't get in trouble.
Okay. All right. Okay, that'll issue. All right. Now, if you need help, I'm willing to go up the hill. If you get scared, just let me know. I'll go up the hill. Here comes another little bill. House bill. Open house bill. Is this going to be work, too?
Mr. Chair, I'm the committee. I don't know. Maybe you want to hear from the witnesses before.
This never stopped me before. Okay, House Bill 2173, open the public hearing. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Hall, and Mr. Miller, please all come forward. The Oregon Health Division is Tom Johnson, Ron Hall, and Sean Miller is with the Oregon Rental Housing Association.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Johnson, I'm the Assistant Administrator of the Oregon Health Division. I have with me today Mr. Ron Hall, who is the section manager of the section that administers the clandestine drug lab cleanup program. the Division of Health has proposed this bill to clarify certain elements of the statute and program that we have discovered in the approximately 10 years that this statute has been in effect. The 1989 legislature enacted this statute to do basically three things. First of all, to protect individuals from toxic substances that are involved in the manufacture of illegal drugs. Secondly, to give homeowners or property owners an indication of when it is appropriate then for human habitation again of the facilities that have been contaminated. And third, to provide landlords and property sellers with the assurance that if they go through this proper process and get a certificate of fitness, that they then will not be open to being sued for use of that property.
You're reading from your testimony you handed out, is that correct?
I am, that's correct.
I see. Okay.
And summarizing it, perhaps.
Oh, okay. Very good.
The full thing. All right. It probably would be good to spend just a minute on the process that is used for these, the cleanup of these labs. The health division works in conjunction with local law enforcement and fire protection agencies in this way. If there is discovered an illegal drug lab, either through a law enforcement action on this drug lab or a fire that's there, that local agency can enter a determination of unfit for use, knowing that that facility had been used for the manufacture of illegal drugs. The homeowner, the property owner, then has the responsibility to use a contractor that the division certifies to do an assessment of that property to see what has to be done to clean it up appropriately. Then the work plan needs to be formulated to clean up that property using, at this point, a certified contractor to do that. After the work has been, the work plan has been approved by the health division so that this is adequate to clean it up properly, and the work is then carried out, there needs to be some sort of an indication that the work has actually been done properly and that the cleanup has been effective. With that documentation, the health division issues a certificate of fitness that allows them the, again, human habitation and use of that property. It's not mandated. A property owner, if they choose to keep the property contaminated, may do so, but if they were to sell it, they must give full disclosure, or if they are then ultimately to use it for human habitation, they would have to get a certificate of fitness. Well, in the course of the administration of these statutes, we found several things that we believe will make the program run more efficiently, more smoothly, more effectively, and we came forward with this bill to make those small changes. Let me just tick off those six things that the bill originally intended to address. First of all, a qualifying statement about the definition to help those law enforcement and fire agencies in the initial determination of unfitness to have some discretion to make it more appropriate that there really has been a significant contamination or a risk to health and not have everything come in and clutter up the system. Secondly, we would make a change to the definition of property to include real estate and make it clear that not only the house or the facility, but also the grounds around that illegal manufacturing site is subject to this bill, this provision. And third, reduce the scope of appeal for initial designation just to whether it was a drug manufacturing site or not. The statute seemed to suggest that the local law enforcement agencies or fire agencies would be put in a situation of making a determination as to whether there was appropriate cleanup, whether there was contamination and so forth. They felt unsure about being put in that situation, and we would agree with that. We think that that determination should be made by the health division, and what should be subject to debate for that initial determination was simply, was it a drug manufacturing site or not? Fourth, in some instances it seemed to be unclear in the statute, even if things had not gone appropriately, could those properties then ultimately get a certificate of fitness? We would like to change the statute to make it clear that, yes, under certain situations, even though things may not have gone appropriately as they should have for the initial cleanup, if it is redone and then gone through the appropriate process, that they could get a certificate of fitness. Fifth, we have asked for expanded civil penalty authority to address willful violations of the existing statutes and rules. Unfortunately, we must report that there are some instances where knowingly individuals have gone contrary to the established procedures. And sixth, we are proposing to reduce the late fee for license renewal from $500 to $100. Now, in the House, there was an amendment that was put forward by the Oregon Rental Housing Association, and Sean is here to talk about that. But before he speaks, we would like to just briefly describe our view of how this would happen. There was a desire to save landlords some money. And in many instances, the cleanup costs do become quite significant. In those instances where there is very little contamination or the process can be carried out in a safe way to the workers, the request was to have the property owner or an employee of the property owner, an existing employee of the property owner, engage in that cleanup. We agreed with that amendment, and that was what changed it to the A. M. Gross version of 2173. And the process would go basically like this. There would still be the determination. There would still be the need for a use of a licensed contractor due to the assessment. There would still need to be a review and approval of the work plan by the health division. But if, in the opinion of the health division, that work could be done in a way which would not unnecessarily expose the owner or the employee of the owner to risks, we would approve that to be done. That hopefully would save the property owner some money. In that case, there would still, though, be the requirement that a licensed contractor would need to certify that, yes, the work was done according to the work plan, and that, yes, in fact, there were tests to indicate that the cleanup had been effective. And then we would issue the certificate of fitness. So with that, we request your support of the A. M. Gross version of House Bill 2173. We would be very pleased to answer any questions if there are any.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Rental Housing Association. We do support House Bill 2173, the amendment that was mentioned on page 2, section 3 of the bill, which does allow a landlord or property owner to self-clean up. Current law is not only are we subject to the fixed cost, but we are also subject to using a licensed contractor to do the cleanup costs. And we are captive of these costs, what average around $5,000 per contaminated site. Recently had a member that had to clean up a site in Portland, costed $9,000. I've heard as high as $16,000. That's the cleanup cost. Again, from these illegal drug labs, not only are the people that they're selling these drugs to victims, but the landlord is a victim. And unfortunately, when these illegal drug labs are found, they're more likely found in rental units. And so we are very much supportive of this issue to try to alleviate some of the costs of the landlord. Now, as was stated, this bill allows the licensed contractor to review the work plan. It only allows, once the health division approves it, the actual work to be done. So if they actually come up with a list saying that they need to paint the walls, they need to replace the carpet, a lot of times that's what they call a minor drug cleanup. Those kinds of repairs and things to the unit can be done by the landlord or agent of the landlord, which could in many instances save $5,000 to $10,000. And remember, our landlords are doing this to provide housing, and if they are unable to afford the cleanup, they're unable to afford housing people. And so it's something that should allow them to do it in a more efficient manner and hopefully clean up and still keep it safe for the community. We would urge your support. Thank you.
You need to testify, Mr. Johnson, or not? Wait, which one?
Mr. Hall.
You need to testify, vote.
Not necessary.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Yes, I just have a problem with Section 7 of the bill where you expand the authority to in the division of civil penalties.
Mr. Senator Nelson, that was one of our biggest concerns on the House side. Without dealing and addressing our issue of the extraordinary cost, they wanted to add on, and the civil penalty now is $2,000. I believe it started out $10,000 or $5,000. We did negotiate that down to $2,000 for people that are willfully, knowingly allowing families to come into a contaminated unit. We felt that was a reasonable approach to try to deter somebody from doing that. Obviously, when something is contaminated, you don't want to have somebody allow children in that. And so if you are put on the unfit for use list, we did feel because of the extraordinary cost that we have to endure now that a $5,000 civil penalty was too high, but we did want something to deter. Now that we are addressing some of the major concerns of cleanup costs within this bill, being able for us to do it ourselves, we did buy off on the compromise of $2,000.
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Nelson, we put that forward after a lot of consideration. Simply, there have been examples where individuals willfully and knowingly have gone forward in a manner which, from our point of view, is risky to the health not only of themselves, but to the people then that they would rent to or the people that would inhabit those facilities. We certainly do not intend to use it heavily. We use it as a last resort where individuals have willfully avoided and have not gone through a process which we feel is important to protect the health of those individuals.
And I guess that's why I'm sure you'd do that, but there might be somebody come along that might use it in a heavy-handed manner.
We understand that, and we understand the potential abuse there, and we would like to go on record saying that this is not going to be used heavy-handedly or frequently, but as a last resort, and in fact, we do not. We really believe that having it there will be more of a deterrent than the actual use. So that's why it's there.
Further questions?
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Does Section 7 apply to any dwelling or just residential dwellings?
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Charnel, any site that has been declared unfit that has been an illegal drug lab.
So it could be a business, it could be a warehouse, it could be in here. Okay. My next question is, there's a division. All these fees are paid for by the property owner, right? Is that correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Charnel, that's correct.
And currently, EEQ has the budget for an undetermined amount of money for the actual site to clean up itself, and that's including, you know, the chemicals, the hardware, and this sort of thing.
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Tarno, thank you for raising that. It's probably important to recognize the distinction between what DEQ does and what the Health Division does. DEQ basically has the responsibility to clean up the immediate mess and to get rid of the bulk chemicals that are there. The Health Division's interest takes place after that occurs, and now is looking at the issue, is that facility fit for human habitation?
And then one last, Mr. Chair. Have we seen a decline in the number of residential dwellings used as meth labs or other illegal labs?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Vitano, unfortunately, I have to report that we have not. We are seeing an increase.
Okay. If I may respond, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Turner, we have found that this issue has escaped the Portland, Eugene area and now is moving into the rural areas. Unfortunately, down in your Coos Bay area, down southern Oregon, we've found this very same problem coming. And it happens outside the rural areas because they try to get away with it, and then they go sell it inside in town. So
really, it has no order, like order in town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One more question.
Yes, yesterday we talked about giving public notice of these contaminated buildings, and there was some opposition actually from the private companies and county clerks. Do you have any suggestions on how you could possibly get around without going to the county clerks or have a potential deal?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Nelson, Ronald Hall, the Environmental Services Manager with the Health Division. Yes, I did attend the hearing yesterday on House Bill 2932. At present, when a facility is designated as a drug lab site, we put it on the Building Code Agency. They have designated an unfit for use list. Properties can be sold subsequently with disclosure that it's on that list. The problem Representative Krasanski was trying to deal with was a couple of instances where property was transferred without that disclosure, and in particular a case where one of those, well, his question was, why didn't this show up in the title search? And we had had some discussions with him about that, and maybe it was our lack of technical knowledge of the title process, but our discussion was more to the effect of we wouldn't have any problem with sending the notice that we send to the Building Codes Agency to the county clerk as well, imagining in some way that it went into a file, and when somebody came to the title search that they would see this, and it would be like a red flag to them. I think that was different than his real intent, which was to actually assign it to the title. When this statute was initiated, the consensus was we needed a way to assure people of the safety of this house, and so that this particular chapter in the house's history or the home or whatever residence or so that could be left behind. So the Health Division has set a relatively rigorous and a high bar in terms of the process that we undergo before we actually certify the place as habitable. And it's that reliance on the certification process and the rigor that is required to acquire it that we believe that everyone can rely on that and therefore not have that permanent stain on the title. So that's kind of the difference. There is a list. We can make another list. We can put it on the website. We can look at some other ways. But his intention was a redundant kind of a notification.
Sure. Thank you.
Further questions? No one else to sign up to close the hearing. House Bill 2173, work session on 2173. Chair moves House Bill 2173A and goes to full due pass recommendation. Any objections? None.
Okay.
Senator Turner, I'd like to carry that bill. Next, order of business, please.
Mr. Chairman, the committee, all the bills that we have for work session, and I saw them just left out the door. So,
For who? That doesn't bother me.
I can tell you that on one bill that we have up for work session that the parties have asked us to put the bill over.
Which one's that?
Relates to 72-hour hold transportation. I'm looking for it right now.
Just so I'll call everybody on.
It is
2436. 2436. Right, 2436 is not going to do today. Okay, next bill.
Chairman of the committee, we also have House Bill 3522, creates a crime of custodial sexual misconduct. We have two sets of amendments before us, the -3, A3, and the -A5. I don't know anything about the -A4. A3 and A5 are basically the same.
Open public hearing.
No, we're at it. What session? Had a public hearing.
Well, no, we'll see what we do. I don't know the work. Go ahead. Open work session. What was it, 35?
Yes, 3522.
22. Anybody?
Mr. Cook is here. I know that they have had some interest, and I see Mr. Tabanky is also here, and they've had some interest in the amendments that they may remember. They testified the last time.
Who wanted these last amendments?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I think, and I'm not sure, he may have come from the Department of Corrections. The A5 came from Representative Manick, and he told me he was more comfortable with the A4 amendments, but we don't have the A4. I think he meant the A3. But I think Mr. Cook maybe can come up here and help us a bit here. I mean, I can tell you the difference between the two. The main difference is the fact that if the inmate initiated the conduct under the A5, then the penalty is reduced by one level. also under the A5, it requires it to be listed as a sex offender under Chapter 181.
Committee, I have to go to budget negotiations, as does Senator Brown, but I appreciate it if Director Cook could explain those ideas. I know Mr. Kadeke has been working on this issue too. This was a bill that, after we heard the testimony, there were concerns raised about the bill. And so I've had conversations and Texas parties together to come up with some different ideas of moving it forward. On other bills that are before us today, on 59, which is public transportation and guns, I have had some amendments drafted. Bill, let's go ahead and put those on. What's probably going to happen to the judiciary in the next few days. You will begin having hearings without Senator Brown and I, and then we'll join you depending on when the breaks on the budget negotiations take place. Right now, the schedule is they intend to negotiate tomorrow in the early afternoon, and so judiciary will probably start maybe a little later, but Senator Brown and I be able to join you, say, by 4 o'clock or so. That's why I'm looking at the time before putting both on the agenda that we're not able to complete.
When do we start tomorrow?
Technically, we start at 1, but we can, as long as it's scheduled at 1 o'clock, we can actually begin it at any time thereafter. But we'll carefully look at the agenda. There's some bills that you can, that I know you can do without a complete public testimony until we get here. On the rest of the items on the agenda today,
Mr. Chairman, if you may, they just recently put over the bill relating to the 72-hour hold at the request of the funding.
Right.
So it's time to negotiate that.
Good.
Bill.
And then we have the Department of Corrections bill again.
We're 35 minutes to that.
59 deals with, as I said, the guns on the buses, and so probably we need to have a full committee to talk about it. Although the amendment,
Senator Charno, you're right. I made them at your request.
Good.
But with that, I will take my views.
Good. Yes, Chris. But we have the votes here, and the committee feel comfortable with it.
Okay, so now we're working on if you're saying goodbye.
Okay.
Are you going goodbye now?
I'm going goodbye now.
We're in the middle of something before you started the oration. We've opened the hearing on public security.
We're in the work session in 4522.
All right.
And we're going to invite maybe Mr. Cook and Mr. Podolsky.
Yes, please. Please come forward. Was Mary Boston involved in this thing?
Yes, she was.
What happened to her? She saw something left.
Right now, some of the purge issues. And
on 59, taking a look at the amendments, and I'd be interested in your comments. If you want to go
to the end.
What comment?
Okay. Let's rock and roll.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. Representative Mannix is available after 3 o'clock as well if you want his input on this. We spoke, actually a number of people, David and myself, Mary Botkin, Claudia Black from DOC, a number of people have been involved in trying to conform this bill to something that would work for everybody. The big issues relate to whether or not it's appropriately in the sexual offenses in the criminal code, whether or not there should be an affirmative defense to the parties in the event that they are charged with the crime, whether or not there would be a lifetime sexual offender registration requirement under 181, and I think that probably David may have some other issues. What we are proposing, Senator Courtney, in endorsing is the House Bill 3522-A4 amendments. And that is something I just presented to you. These are DOC amendments in cooperation with Representative Mannix. This does not have the affirmative defense
it does remain, charges do remain in the sexual offenses of the criminal code. What it does on page 3 of this dash 4 amendment, though, which I think alleviates concerns of the committee, at least some members of the committee, relates to registration for those people who commit the crime and are convicted of it. They are only required to register as lifetime sexual offenders if the victim of the offense is under the age of 18. So it only relates to juveniles, not to adult inmates of the Department of Corrections. So the Department of Corrections, and I won't speak for Representative Marys, but we are in agreement with him relative to this bill. David has some other input on this, and I have some, I think I have in a sense agreement with him as well on some of the issues. I just don't know how we package up this bill to meet everybody's needs at this point.
David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, I'd like to give staff copies of it. And if I could, Mr. Chair, I just want to suggest some possible conceptual amendments and see if the committee is interested in going in that direction before having legislative council draft them up. But our suggestion would be to look at the existing crime of official misconduct, and which shows up in Chapter 162 rather than Chapter 163, where the sex offenses are listed. In a conversation I had with District Attorney Dale Penn, he said that many of these cases, when they are prosecuted, are currently prosecuted as official misconduct, but that the issue of proving mens rea is a problem in those cases. And so the concept that I have would be to move this offense to Chapter 162, essentially make it give it a different name, which would be custodial misconduct, and provide that it is a misdemeanor offense, essentially track the existing provisions in the A4 amendments, with the exception of adding an affirmative defense where the inmate instigated the sexual contact. And again, Mr. Chair, our concern is in those few instances where, in fact, the sexual contact was consensual, we believe that that defense should be available, that it sets a bad precedent to make a crime of an offense where there was, in fact, consensual conduct between two adults. Even though there may be a power disparity, we believe the appropriate remedy is to fire the corrections officer. I understand that under current law, their certification from DPSST would be revoked if they were terminated for this reason, and that it's the only reason it's important to have them be convicted of a crime is so that that would show up in a criminal records check if they applied for a similar position in another state. That in any event, they could not be rehired in the state of Oregon as a corrections officer because they would not have their certification any longer. So what we're really talking about is providing protection for folks in other states where these individuals might go to get another job. And again, Mr. Chair, I think, and I assume Director Cook will confirm this, the biggest problem in the Oregon correction system has not been male corrections officers victimizing female inmates, but female corrections officers being seduced by male inmates. And that is not appropriate. It is not appropriate for those female corrections officers to accede to those advances by those inmates. They should and have been fired and should continue to be fired in the future. Their certification should be removed. We just don't think they should necessarily be sent to jail. So if the committee is interested in our concept, we would certainly have that drafted by legislative council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree with David in with regard to the jail term. I don't think that's necessary at all. I think the termination is important. The loss of certification is important. I think what I have significant difficulty with is the affirmative defense piece, simply because I think that it's a violation of code of ethics issues and other, for me, important issues in the Department of Corrections for me to endorse an affirmative defense when an inmate entices a correctional officer into this kind of behavior. So I have difficulty endorsing that, but if you see fit to move the bill with that kind of provision, and I think the bill is important enough, if that becomes the case, that we'll live with it, but it would not be my first choice, and I don't think it sends the right message to allow that to be a defense. But I think some of the points that David and the union have made are important, and I also agree with the notion that the official misconduct location for this is appropriate if, in fact, it appropriately fits in the official misconduct 162 chapter. And again, I can't answer that from a legal standpoint.
Mr. Chair, just one additional point I forgot to make, which is that if it was placed with official misconduct in Chapter 162, we believe there would be no need to have the mandatory registration provision. If a corrections officer victimizes a juvenile inmate, that is prosecutable under current law as sex abuse. And if they were convicted of sex abuse, they would be required to register for the rest of their life.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, there's one other piece that, for the record, I'm Mary Botchin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. There's one other piece that we thought was fairly important that did not make it into the amendment, and it was to be an amendment of forcible compulsion, where an officer is compelled by an inmate through threats or other means to engage in inappropriate behavior. And we think that's pretty important that be included in the bill, because there are, by definition, these are bad guys. An officer could be threatened, and I think our female officers are probably more at risk in some ways than other folks. That could be more real.
Questions? Mr. Chair, the department also endorsed the notion of the forcible compulsion piece and so it's positive.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I heard that Hank David indicate that they're looking at or will consider some amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I also heard the director indicate that they may be somewhat receptive to those. I'm wondering if we couldn't have those drafted and bring this one back.
Okay.
At least, and I'm not saying I'm approving them, you understand. I just want to take a look at them and then maybe come to a decision.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I actually think that in amongst all of the disagreement, there are a number of areas where we actually could agree. I know that David hates this bill generally, but I think we could make it a workable bill if, and I know it's late in the session, but I think if we can get this thing done, it'll move rather quickly. And I do like the idea of putting it in 162 over the sex offense, because I really do believe that these folks are, if our members are doing something inappropriate, it is not, I don't believe it's a sex crime. I think it's just inappropriate behavior. And as we said early on, they lose their job. I mean, there really is no wiggle room here. And provided the department does the termination correctly.
I don't like to say it's like Bruce Murray.
I know it's hard for you, Senator, but it'll be okay.
All right, thank you for the questions. Close the public hearing. Thank you for your testimony. And open public hearing on what's this, 5-9? 5-9?
Watch this one closely, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the dash 15 amendments to Senate Bill 59. You may amend this bill once more. You can come back. May I amend this bill before you?
other occasions.
I'm going to give you a courtesy vote.
Okay.
That's what it is.
That's fine.
Chair, members of the committee, what the...
$5.
Remove from the bill that issue that relates to courthouses that make the site remain in the mass transit vehicles and allow you to have to get on a mass transit vehicle to the far end, as the bill is now in a case, but it also allows you to carry ammunition so long as that ammunition is not something that can be used by the firearm. It also sets a 3-level for penalties. The first one's an, for the first time, it's an infraction. Then I think it goes to a C misdemeanor and then an A misdemeanor.
Hey, John. Where are you? No, wait. This is, so we got amendments, please, the dash?
Dash 16, I believe. We should have it before you.
I think the dash 16 amendments, there won't be objections to those, will we? Loosen up. I'm going to move, the chair moves the dash 16 amendments to Senate Bill 590. Any objections? Hearing none, we adopted those. I'm ready to move it, but I got to have the vote, so I got to know what's going on here.
I'll be a no vote. I'll just make it easy for everybody.
You'll be a no vote? Well, then that means you can't go.
Okay, John, yeah. I'll let you go on that real fast. Take the heat off my...
Bring it back, get your chair.
Bring it back, tell you why you need for another
I'll
thing.
Be gone tomorrow, the next day, so you guys can go
home. Hey, we'll have
to get back tomorrow. We'll make the
24-hour notice. Yeah. I'm Friday. So you just can't buy this under any circumstances?
No. Just make it very difficult for everybody.
I did my turn too, Mr. Chair, so I'm going to do it.
Well, unless I can pull somebody out of committee, which I guess I can.
Well, you want to, where are they? Do you
want me to try? Where are they hiding? Are they off hiding somewhere? What are you guys doing negotiating, Republicans?
They don't tell us. That's tough secret.
Burdick is out of town. Brown and Brian are together.
She's back
tomorrow. I don't know where she is. She needs to be involved, if you think.
Well, it's
kind of
her thing, isn't it?
I don't know.
This
bill is maybe her
thing.
Okay. Well, all right. I'm not going to beat a horse that's a good horse. I'm going to just say, you got to go with life as it is. You know what I mean? I mean, you got to take life as it comes. There's those who give courtesy votes, and there's those who... They won't do that. They want to make you sweat and hurt and... They want to put stress in your body and your life. And
well, when I gave it to you, you didn't come and vote.
So there's nothing I can do. I mean, I can't. Can I get out of here with your vote and the three votes? Can I say that I can't do this?
Sure. Well, the committee is only the things that the bill has to do. It has to pass the House. It has to pass the Senate. That's it.
No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not crazy. All right, I did all I could do in 59. I got to close the hearing because I can't get it out. Now, what else you got to do?
Mr. Chair, members of committee, that's it. I have to go to the House Judiciary Committee
meeting at 4:00. Well, that doesn't mean I can't do stuff without you. All right, is there anything else for the good of the order? Thank you very much for being here. Do we have rules today, fine?
We got rules, fine.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, I love it.